Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
We now return to our conversation with Rudy Rutenberg from Maze Arcana, discussing Inkwell Society, Xanathar's Notes to Everything Else, the Dungeon Master's Guild Adepts, a whole bunch of wonderful stuff. Enjoy. So, the Dungeon Master's Guild Adepts, I don't know what that is. Can you explain that to me?
Yes, the Dungeon Master's Guild Adepts, which we just fondly kind of call ourselves Guild Adepts, is a collection of some of the top authors or budding new authors that D&D has cultivated to put out what essentially is same-day DLC. Most of us are already on the playtest list for the new supplements that are going to be coming out, whether that's new rules books, whether that's mostly it's new books, but sometimes it's the adventures, you know, et cetera. And when we get access to those things, we are allowed to start formulating together what kind of products we think would be great for delving a little deeper. So Tomb of Annihilation was our first opportunity to really dive in with something. And a lot of people created like side adventures, kind of things that are in the mix for lower level parties, or if you're an upper level party that wants to get involved, or you wanted to spend more time in Port Nyanzaru than the book had reasonably available. Those were things that they wanted us to consider, wanted us to put together. And so you can get a lot of extra little bumps for a group if, say, you know, they hit a trouble spot, or you wanted to spend more time in the swamps, basically just like a way to expand upon what is already available in the book. And so we do the same thing for Xanathar's. I took and created, or I was the lead designer on Xanathar's Lost Notes, which was a collection of about 25 new player options and some new DM options. So it mirrored what Xanathar's already was, but had a good amount of extra stuff that we felt like there was still kind of a hole that was left. So for instance, there is an arcane trickster, but there's not really a divine option for that. So one of the things that we endeavored to do was create a divine herald, which gave you the feel of, you know, the rogue with the heart of gold kind of thing. The one that's that is maybe actually being sneaky and in service to a patron or deity. We want, without you having to multi-class into cleric or just being a trickster cleric, we wanted to give you the option to still enjoy the sneak attack and whatnot without not being able to, like, without only having the role play aspect of being a divine servant. We wanted you to get some mechanical semblances with it as well. One of the other bloodlines that we did for sorcerers was the Fae Sorcerer. So, you know, essentially you can look at that as like, oh, isn't that like a druid? Well, not really. You know, that could very easily just be somebody who manifests some of the, without being the nature, the storm type druid, the druid that actually has fae blood, like fairy blood in them, and what that looks like, what kind of things can that creature do that is maybe a more elevated form of like an Aladrin or something of those lines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that was a collection of a good deal. I think all but one of the guild adepts participated in that one. And there's another product that should be coming out in a bit that kind of delves in deeper to the lore behind a lot of where these archetypes would come from, or where these, for instance, monks don't have a whole bunch of exciting lore behind their monasteries and stuff like that. So there are lists of heroes of the realms and their monasteries and the practices of those monasteries and things like that that are coming up in a new product that will be coming out prior to some of the new books, which I know Mordenkainen's has been announced already. So that's that one's fine. there'll be stuff that we're doing for that as well. But the new products that come out behind that, you know, that's really what the Guild adepts are for. We're there to kind of like show people that like this is the level that we're doing. We're, you know, it's like we're not pro, but we're semi-pro in the sense that like this is the level that if you want to write for Wizards or any of the other ones, we all do that. We all write for all of the other publishers. And so if this is a job field that you want to get in, you have a diagram of saying, oh, I know that besides just looking at printed Wizards material, I can look at the Guild adepts and see their material. It's see how it works inside my own game, and then also have this as a thing that I can format towards, I can shoot towards, and without feeling like it's so far out of reach as like the Wizard stuff, because we don't get to really mess around with any assets other than what anybody else could. The only difference is that we're on the playtest group, so we get a little bit more time to formulate, you know, what we're gonna put out, and we do it as a team. We do it together.
So that's the correlation that Guide to Everything and Notes to Everything Else has. That's sort of like the DLC or the supplemental part to the Guide to Everything.
Yeah, that's actually how we is as being that DLC. And same day is what we shoot for, but a lot of these things are us having very little time to put those out. I pulled a lot of sleepless nights on XLN because not only did we have to... Xanathar's Guide to Everything had a long development process, as rightly it should. For the DLC content, we had a couple of months, which meant that we were taking subclasses, making them very quickly, doing the best amount of balance that we could in-house, and then getting them playtested as best we could, taking notes, going back through. And you'll notice there's typos still in Xanathar's Lost Notes, which we still endeavor to fix. We have actually all of our notes on what we want to fix. Those typos would never have come out in a full-out Wizards product because they go through like probably like three times the amount of development, and they have dedicated editors who are getting paid. We don't get paid anything other than what people pay us on the Guild. That's it.
You say there won't be typos, but I distinctly remember a sap doing a D163 at some point in time in a Wizards of the Coast Player's Handbook.
Sure, you know, there's errata. We can fix things and all of that stuff. But I guess the main thing is people were like, oh, like that was kind of the complaint that we got. I'm actually very, very proud of the fact that nobody is calling us out for like, this is terribly unbalanced. This doesn't work. Da, 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 da. There's really like... There's a couple of things that people are theory crafting about not being able to work from like a level 20 paladin feature. And I'm just like, okay, well, when you get there and you test that out, you let me know if it is so much more, you know, like aggressive or whatever than the level 20 druid or something along those lines. Like, sure, have fun with that. Tell me how it goes. But for the most part, I'm very proud of the work that our guys did on that. And you know, we did spend quite a bit of time, especially during the holidays, when having to take care of our families, entertaining them, doing all of the craziness that the holidays provides for you, and still putting out a pretty high quality booklet that was number one on the DM's Guild for I think 5 months, if it's not. And it's been dethroned for a couple of days or so at a time, and then usually pops back up. I haven't looked at it recently, but I'm very proud that it went to platinum as quickly as it did. I think it went to platinum within the first month.
Yeah,
that's pretty impressive.
That's great.
It got platinum before my Adventures League module 7-3, which I think got released before it. It went platinum before that.
Wow.
Well, when you have a team working on something, it makes everything better, right?
Typically, yeah. Sometimes, I mean, and that's also where, you know, lines of communication are so important, and setting down the guidelines or the mechanics for how your group is going to function is super important, because a lot of those errors that are in that are actually very easily avoidable errors that we made because we were at the level of exhaustion that we were from churning that thing out. I would say that we were all very... towards the end of that, we were all rolling with disadvantage because we had multiple levels of exhaustion. We were moving at a very slow pace. And I'm honestly not sure that I'm even recovered from it right now because of the undertaking that was. It was far more than anything else that we had done prior to that.
Lots of fatigue. All the negatives to your stats. Do you personally have a favorite rule mechanic or anything else that you guys made for XLM?
Well, I created a system in there that you can use for factions and stuff like that. It's called the suspicion mechanic, and it doesn't necessarily only mean like a negative situation. It's meant to more be a way to measure favor. And that's in a sense of it originally came out of the design idea or the hole that we were worried about being that when you are trying to be sneaky, you're sneaking around and you bungle a stealth check, then you're kind of dead in the water and you may expose your entire group, depending on what's going on and what the situation is. And it encouraged people to be able to have more of an espionage type game where you might get spotted, but people don't necessarily know that you have untoward mission or feeling going on. You're very much in a situation where you could talk it out, but without just resorting to another singular check that you could bungle, we're also like setting it up to where, okay, well, you didn't, you know, see this happen, or you did see that happen, or you were able to talk your way out of that. But even further beyond that, you don't just drop it at that point. Like, oh, okay, you did, you know, you failed your stealth check, but you made a good con save. Great, all's forgotten. We keep moving. This allows you to create a sense of urgency and also of kind of that persistent entire world where people actually remember seeing you. And talking your way out of a thing the first time is substantially easier. Talking your way out of it the 15th time should be a lot harder than the first time, especially if, you know, you're sneaking by some of the guards from the same faction or the guards of the same kingdom or something like that.
Or the same guards.
Right, like where they would have conversations with each other. Oh, you know, this interesting thing happened to me today. This tiefling. It's kind of like this bluish purple color with fiery eyes and smelled like brimstone, but like not the other brimstone, like this very specific brimstone. Yeah. Stumbled out of the shadows and then said some things. And I was like, that's awesome. I should totally forget about this. Like you don't have that conversation going on. Right. In most D&D games, it is just forgotten and brushed under the rug. So I wanted to create a thing where DMs could set up a faction system or set up a measuring system in which at what point the King's guards are like, all right, dude, I keep telling you not to show up here. I don't care. Whatever it is you have to say, I don't care. You're going to jail.
It's the network of guards in Skyrim, where if you've done a crime across the land, the guard that you're in the next town over is like, hey, don't you have a bounty on your head?
Yeah, and I also put in some stuff in there about like what happens if you kill that guard, so that your reputation within that faction doesn't go up, or does it? You know, like it never made sense to me when like in EverQuest, if you killed a guard, like it was just like faction hit, faction hit, faction hit, faction hit, faction hit, but nobody else is around. How do they know? Kind of thing.
It's all the horses that are staring at you.
Yeah, the the pixels have eyes.
Spy horse.
Sorry, Skyrim references. So this just creates a lot of really good options for you to get creative when you're hiding the bodies, I assume.
Yeah, I think so. And then beyond that, I created with Rich Lescafleur the Rune Guard, which kind of takes the idea of the rune mechanics, which we had like kind of a little UA on, I think, about a year or so ago, and solidified it into a usable mechanic that is balanced for a fighter and almost acts in a way that the Eldritch Knight does, but without just saying, here's more spells and here are some other features. It almost makes you kind of feel like you always have epic equipment going on. As you level, it gets stronger, but it's actually based on your character's level of knowledge, which we thought was fun.
That's interesting. So that one, I haven't seen it. I'm assuming it is like etching runes into your armor and your weapons and stuff like that that have like abilities and stuff.
Yeah. So for that one, it's very much like, let me see. If you thought about the glyph system that was incorporated into games as far back as like Diablo, where
Oh, yes.
You're able to to put gems or something into an item. And those gems are like, oh, there's a fire gem, there's a life gem, there's an earth gem. Well, this takes it a step further and says, of course, you know the rune. Everybody knows the rune. But what makes you able to infuse power into that rune? And it's about the other things that are like basically the conjugation of those runes to be able to dictate how they interact with the items that you have, whether it's a weapon or your boots or your breastplate. And there are several offensive, like each rune has an offensive, a defensive, a what's roughly a skill-based rune. And then what happens when you expend the power of all of those runes instantly? That kind of stuff.
It reminds me of the Hexblade for the Warlock, but without being a Warlock.
Yeah.
And without the incantations, really.
Right. And it's less about hexing in that sense, because you're not... And there's a lot of new mechanics in Xanathar's Guide that are like marking or creating a situation where you've got, it's almost like doing a Hunter's Mark or Hex on somebody. That's a lot of new features that are like that. But with the Rune Guard, you are essentially deciding in the morning what you think the day is going to bring. And then you're basically holding out and waiting for those moments to happen to activate the item. And it lasts for a number of rounds equal to, I think, your constitution modifier. I don't have it open in front of me, and I don't have it memorized anymore. I did.
Anymore being the key part.
Yeah, I actually had it fully memorized. I still have most of the PHB and Xanathar's memorized, but I don't have that one anymore.
Ooh. Is that a thing with you? Because I know with me, whenever I'm working on a mechanic for a game, not that I've published any, but anytime I'm working on any mechanics or anything I'm really interested in, it's like, oh, did you write that down? I'm like, no, I can remember the whole thing.
I typically write notes down on them, but like it sticks because it's in the forefront of your mind, right? Right now, unless I'm using something specifically from it, it's not in the forefront of my mind. And when I write them down, I make my notes. I do like to, I guess it's because I'm juggling a whole bunch of different types of mechanics at the same time that I typically do write them all down and I compare them to each other because I don't want to do guesswork at what my mechanics are. I want to make sure that they're precise.
I agree with you, having no knowledge of how mechanics work.
Nathan doesn't do game design. Nathan just goes, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, think about it like it's math, right? You can get to the right answer if you've memorized whatever the thing is. But sometimes you need to refer back to notes. And if you haven't made any notes, then you don't have anything to refer back to. And especially when we're working on 20 plus player options, it's important to have all of those notes. Plus, there's a very specific way that 5th edition requires things to be written so that they are flexible, but they are still rules as written, right? Mm-hmm. So I like to call it Jeremy jargon from time to time. I don't know how he feels about it when I say it like that. I should probably say it one time and like watch his eyes to see what he says. But good, I do like to call it that because while Mike does write a lot, like he's the big mechanics person in that thing, Jeremy is the one that makes sure that it is the rules as written, that it is airtight or as airtight as it can be. And if you want to see an example of that, go and look at some of the subclasses that were in the UA that made it from the UA into Xanathar's and see how the wording differs and see, oh, well, like what kind of, and this is a game designer exercise. This is something that I've done because it's a thing that I'm like, oh, well, how do I do this? How do I do this differently? Is that I'll look at the way that it was designed for the UA, which is largely Mike. I mean, Jeremy does do a quick run for it, but it's obviously not, you know, going out for mass use as a finalized thing. So they knock that out, they put it out. You can look at that, and then you can look at what made it into Xanathar's and go, okay, how are these worded different? All right, this is how. Why are they worded different? Okay, what does that mean towards the grand scheme of the game? And that's how you'll actually learn quite a bit about mechanics just by dissecting and breaking it down. It's almost like trying to build a watch based off of breaking one down versus trying to build a watch based off of your theoretical knowledge of how they work.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's like you get the exploded view of something and you can see every single little part and then you can kind of like piece it back together.
Yeah. Tony Stark is one of the best examples that we have. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Iron Man, thank you for that. But see, Alex, Math the RPG, I can make that.
No.
Yes, I am making that.
It's already, everything is Math the RPG. That's not a, that's already what we've, that's actually Math the RPG was fourth edition, so.
That was fourth edition, okay. Yeah. I like literally had the idea of like maybe a trigonometry professor is making you sit in class and forcing you to do math proofs before you can move on with the adventure. Like maybe just make it literal. I don't know if anyone played that. I don't think so.
Yeah, you got to be careful with things like that because otherwise, like we're talking about fantasy, right? And we're walking this very fine line in Inkwell right now where they're doing a lot of mundane tasks.
Yeah.
And they're level zero, right? So I'm not going to throw them into something absolutely ridiculous and I need to give them a good bit of danger. I guess it's no spoiler for me to say that they're doing what amounts to like a reverse library heist right now.
Okay.
Where they need to plant a book back in the library in a specific place so that the librarian would believe or that the person who checked it out would have plausible deniability that they already turned back in the book and they shouldn't get this late fee kind of thing.
Right. All right. Excellent.
And so the players, the first session, they went about it rather literally. In the sense of like, they're going to go, they're going to get library cards, they're going to do all this stuff, which is not what I wanted them to do at all. I wanted them to go and case the place and to like think about what were the opportunities or the avenues that they could go in and do the thing, which I gave them all the rules of the job up front, like what they needed to do. And I expected them to do something like that, but they were used to a more role play based situation where they wanted to go in and try and discern all of this information individually. But it did serve the purpose that I was trying to get them to work as a team and plan what they were going to do and then split up because they individually do not have the amount of time they need to get all of the information and execute the plan on their own. So while that episode for me is a little, I'm not going to say it's like really frustrating, but it's trying more in the sense that I'm like trying to get the point across that like, sure, go your own way, do your own thing, wait for failure.
I get you.
Do the things together, learn how to appropriately split the party, and then you will actually become a greater sum of your parts kind of thing.
Okay. I now hereby declare this Ocean's Eberron. Does that make sense?
It's the intent. It is what I intend to do. And it's following along with the rest of the story that I have planned out is like, I really wish I could just tell you everything that's going to go down, but I don't want to ruin it. I'm so enthusiastic about it.
Absolutely.
That I don't want to.
Yeah.
DM secrets that you just want to play another game and you're super excited for what's going to happen.
Yeah, I love those games, those sessions where you get to a part and people are like, I didn't want to stop yet. And it's like, we have to because we're actually on a schedule of Twitch. We can't keep going.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you guys especially have to when you're doing it like that.
It can be grueling, too. Like it because when you're at a table, you're only considering the enjoyment of yourself and the players that are there with you. You only have to consider that and how the story moves into that. So you could get bogged down in the minutia of something so insignificant, but as long as everybody's engaged, that's fine. However, in a streaming context, you still have to make sure you're providing good pacing and story. So getting bogged down in how a hinge on a door works is not necessarily the best thing.
Right.
But making sure that players don't feel like you're shortchanging them. Like, I had a player want to get a library card. I didn't really want her to spend the time to go through the library card. And at the same time, I wanted to enforce the doldrum that will be bureaucracy if that's the path they decide.
Suddenly you're forced to have an NPC librarian that knows all the rules and regulations of getting library cards.
Right. Which I wasn't necessarily excited about. And they wanted to go through and get a library card. She wanted to get a library card, and she wanted to, she's like, well, how much does it cost to get a library card? And like, no, it's library cards are free. Well, what if, okay, so then how long does it take? And it's like, well, if you want one for free, it's going to take a couple of weeks. Well, I need to get it now. All right, well, then it doesn't. Then it's going to cost a little bit of money. And I'll, you know, do this thing. But then she was nice to the NPC and did, you know, like braided her hair. And so I let that be like a form of payment. She skipped the girl to the front of the line and stuff like that. But I didn't even want them to get bogged down in that. At the same time, it was a good role-playing moment, and it fulfilled what she wanted to do. So while it doesn't necessarily fit the plan that I have, that's fine. I don't care. I'm not that kind of a DM. I tend to let players linger in moments because I want to see where they're going to go and what's important to them. And to me, that's just as important as any storyline or idea that I have. In fact, if they don't ever get around to it, and if they fail this thing, there will be consequences to the failure. And I'll just be like, well, the reward you got was a library card.
That's something. Learning is knowledge.
But I already.
While we're talking about the Inkwell Society, because I do want to touch on that a little bit more, for some reason, I always want to say Writers Guild, because I see Inkwell and think writers, and society and think guild. But what does the name Inkwell Society actually mean?
It's funny because I am in the Writers Guild.
Yeah.
Extraneously there, but the Inkwell Society was a term that we decided on as a sort of like storytellers collective. Okay. We wanted that to be something that other people, like, it wasn't just us. We do everything like you were talking about earlier with inclusivity. We do everything with inclusivity and the sense of community. So we wanted people that were watching Inkwell to say, oh, I'm a part of the society. This is like a secret society, like it's an honored thing, but it's also a thing that I'm allowed in and I'm a part of and I'm allowed to contribute to. And like people have contributed the like drinks to Eberron, like alcoholic beverages for the old Dominion bar where lounge and casino where they spend a good majority of their time. So we have these interesting opportunities to have the community be a part of what we're doing. And we also wanted Inkwell Society to outlive just the one campaign. So with my friends, we wanted to set it up to where if we wanted to make a new show somewhere later where maybe I'm not Dungeon Master, or maybe it's, you know, a different set of heroes running around Eberron or whatever, we had the license to do that without losing the identity of the show or the consistency of it. So that people, when they hear Inkwell Society, they're not like, oh yeah, that thing that happened. It's like, oh, there's going to be more Inkwell Society. It's a new storyline. Awesome. It's the same thing with the Guild Adepts, right? We create a certain expectation of storytelling that we roll through consistently, and people can hear that and go, oh good, I know that's going to be fun. I want to see what's going on.
I had heard the term neon noir put to it. Is that an accurate term?
Yeah, it is. It's not so much in a library per se, but for the most part, when they're going about their day to day in the city, in the Old Dominion, there are a lot of elements of that where I try to add the neon and even the magic kind of light show essence of it to this big mystery. And the noir part does come from the idea that each little job that they pull off is going to give them a little bit more insight or more clues. Where a lot of D&D games play with rewards as being extrinsic things. I get money, I get a new sword, I get whatever.
Sure.
I'm gaining power. But what an intrinsic thing would be is like, oh, I'm getting a step closer to becoming a more complete person. I'm getting a step closer to unraveling this mystery. The choices I'm making actually have some effect on the world and the friends around me, besides I'm getting stronger kind of thing. Right. Or I can buy a new, stronger sword, that kind of stuff. So the noir portion of it is that they come to the table with flaws. That was all I let them start their character generation with. And then they as a group kind of said, well, what are the elements of a mystery or of a noir? And how do we break that, what is usually a single character, down into individuals that can have extra flaws and have all of these interesting story points? And what is their purpose in the world? What are they hoping to correct in the things that have happened to them in their past? So I'm actually really proud of their backstories and the things that are going to come up in the course of the story that are going to reveal just how terrible of people they really are. Because I feel like we can all kind of relate to that. And we need to see those sort of things in our storytelling. Right. And I think that's why we've had this insurgence of the anti-hero in a lot of our pop culture.
It's because we're so used to seeing all just the hero, like the flawless hero, like, oh, it's Superman. He's just a really great guy who's got these superpowers and saves people from being killed.
Yeah. And we want to feel that conundrum that what would I do in this situation? And it's really hard for us to find a connection to an all-powerful being that always makes the right decisions.
Right.
Because we don't, and we're all fallible. And that's something that we can relate to.
So I shouldn't just be a godly paladin who does no wrong. I should have a troubled past and am atoning for my sins.
And why are you a paladin? What led you to that path? Was it you were born with, like, are you Jesus? Or, you know, I think the interesting thing would be seeing a Judas character who, instead of hanging himself, writes his oath breaker, you know, ways.
That would actually be a really interesting paladin, I think.
Based on guilt, almost.
See, now you need to make a redemption paladin in one of your Dungeon Masters Guild Adepts parts, where they are an Oathbreaker to begin with, but regain the powers of paladin slowly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Xanathar's Guide has a redemption paladin, and I think that there should have been probably something in there. I mean, it also may go without saying, but there could be something in there to say, you know, this is, if you want to transition, this is how you handle a character who was this sort of paladin for so long, and then does this, becomes an Oathbreaker, and then Redemption Paladin is the only one. Redemption or Vengeance are the only ones that are available to them after that, or something. I don't know. But that's always a very interesting idea. And I think as a DM, it's a wonderful thing to say to a player who wants to have that wild ride, say, like, yes, that's a thing we can do. We have this subclass and this subclass and this subclass, and this is how we're going to handle it. You will whole cloth change from being a Paladin of Devotion to an Oathbreaker. And then this quest, this quest, this quest, this quest, through those things, even if they're just side quests, through those things, you can redeem yourself, and this is what you'll become.
I think that's always, always fun to see how a character grows and changes. And I don't think, typically, I don't think the classes necessarily reflect the character's changes like that, for sure.
Oh, yeah. And I don't think that you necessarily need it to be a paladin in order to go through these transitions. But one thing we were talking about last night is I've said that I probably won't even level the characters up in Inkwell until, you know, they go through, they might not level all season and they're going to have to seek out mentors, and they're going to have to go through, you know, individual quests on the side and seek things out on their own in order to prove that, like, in order to really earn the level. So once they, you know, if they acquire enough experience, that's only the first part of it. I feel like too often we don't put the appreciation into leveling up that we ought to, because, like, oh, look, I hit the number. Right? But you always feel more deserving or more reverent for something you get when you've completed something to get it, when you've done a task or whatever. And I think that there's a lot of character development to be done in the learning of those things. You know, most of the books that we have, most of the things that we do, a lot of the journey is the becoming of an expert in something. And I don't like it when you just montage over those things. I think that it's a very important part of a character's growth.
Yeah. So you like milestones over the XP system?
I think that the XP system is a little bit of a holdover from the gold purchasing of skills and levels and stuff like that from older options. I do like the idea of needing to purchase training or pay for the things that you're doing in, you know, the time investment or money investment, but you don't want those to be a sink. You don't want that to be something that is just dragging people down. So to me, I think milestones of deciding when a character has the fortitude or has earned the right to go through a thing is much more reflective in the idea of milestones and serves your stories. And that's the collective stories of the group better for it to be a milestone. You can still use experience as a way to judge whether or not they've reached that milestone, but my characters can't kill anything right now.
Right.
So the traditional path of this is how you gain experience is not a thing that works for them.
Right.
And if you wanted to say that they're still in an experience system, it is. They're just getting experience for completing the actual tasks as opposed to besting a creature.
Right. I was just going to say that so much of the time it feels, at least from my perspective, that I have to battle things in order to get experience. But I like the idea that there are other options in order for me to progress.
Well, to be fair, for instance, in D&D, the DMG gives you XP for the monsters, but there's not really a set scale of XP to gain from doing mundane tasks or roleplay encounters or, you know, completing quests. It's not a structure that's necessarily as solid, and in a lot of cases, it's missing. So killing monsters ends up being the fastest way to gain the power you seek.
It's the most understandable way. Because again, we come down to rules being a clear line of communication. So if you're looking for a way for you to clearly communicate to all your players, like, this is how you can start to plan for these things, then yeah, the killing of monsters, the experience, little stuff like that, that all works. However, it's still an interesting topic to say, like, oh, well, what is the challenge rating of this specific task? And then assigning experience, you could still break it down just like you would do CR for creatures. There's nothing that stops you from doing that. And it actually might even, I should go back and do some math on this, or Nathan can, since he's excited about math, the RPG.
Oh, yeah, so much.
You can go through and say, well, what would be the equivalent CR for a task of this magnitude? And how does that break down for a group of characters of this level and of this level and of this level? Because that could be one way to kind of create a hybrid system between the two. But milestones for people typically either go a session or every couple of sessions, or when you complete a story arc. And I think right. that story arc part for me is pretty much what we're doing for Inkwell. However, if they don't complete the story, they don't get anything. And if they don't, beyond that, once they complete the story arc, they only have earned the opportunity to seek out that mentor and then to have the role play elements with the mentor to earn being that. And I may even have a thing where a player goes, finds a mentor, and then starts to train with that mentor, and the mentor just goes, no. No, this isn't working out. Sorry. No. Pick something else.
Nope, you're bad at this. Or I just don't want to train you. Sorry.
Yeah, like what if they fit? Like what if a bard is not good at the thing that other bard mentor is doing? Well, I guess you're not going to study under me, so find somebody else or pick a different, you know, path.
A couple failed performance checks and you get kicked out.
Yeah, maybe. Funny. But yeah. I also am the kind of DM that allows the player to perform in lieu of rolling, so...
That's fair. Because that's actually role-playing.
Exactly.
On that actual note, I did have a question for you. It doesn't pertain to mechanics per se. It's a personal question. Do you prefer being a dungeon master or a player?
I probably prefer DMing.
You like to pull the strings and tell the stories?
I like to engage and to weave, I guess, back and forth. I have a particular style that I enjoy And that's not to say I don't like playing. I love playing. But I guess maybe it's just that I don't really have time to do both right now. If I had to pick one or the other, it's probably the idea that I'm the dungeon master in most of these scenarios.
Being an actor, do you think it helps with the ability to role play and do improv work as a dungeon master and tell stories? Is that something you think is really beneficial? Or the opposite way around, do you think that being a role player has helped you in your acting?
Well, I think that they probably feed into each other, but maybe this is one of the reasons why I like being the DM, is I love being able to move between different characters. And I like the idea, I'm more of a helper kind of character person, as in like, not as in like I play a cleric or something, but I mean as in that I would prefer to facilitate a story and allow other people the joy of playing through it as an individual character. I enjoy very much so getting to see the elation on people's faces when they've figured things out or they've made something that was particularly meaningful to them, because I helped create the meaning of that. So I enjoy that portion of it. And I do think that being an actor and loving the craft of that certainly helps in being a good DM and creating memorable characters that the individuals playing their PCs, the players, can enjoy the interactions that they're going to have. Like, I think right now the fan favorite or the player favorite for Inkwell is Robert Flair. Mm-hmm. Who is a he is the club dad, I guess. Like, he takes care of all the showgirls, and Rose is like his favorite, that he like repairs her dresses and stuff like that. And he's very much like this character from Birdcage, the Hank Azaria character. I think he's
Rose. Oh, come to Robert. I see you've got a snag in your dress. You know Robert can fix that.
It is no trouble. Oh, like, he's just like, he's got this cooing kind of thing that everybody seems to really appreciate. And I love getting to see the characters and the players just cracking up and trying to keep straight faces when I'm interacting with them. And I like that a lot.
I too enjoy that too. I did see you do that, and I would have been right along with them, not knowing how to keep a straight face while that was happening. I did have a question though, real quick. I know we're a little short on time, but about Eberron as a setting, why do you use that as a setting for Inkwell Society?
I'm a big fan of the idea of using, like, what would a world be like that used magic almost in place or to all science. And I think that's something that we see very interestingly in a lot of other settings, stories that we get to watch, where it's like, oh, well, how is the world different with just this one or two other items that have been changed? And where would the evolution of this world have gone to if, you know, we didn't have to develop the way that we use airplanes, for instance, right? And creating an aero and thermodynamic system for making these machines function as they did, but rather we kind of stopped at a certain industrial age, and then our discoveries in magic helped to elevate that next thing. And what I like about Eberron is that everything is available in Eberron, so there is no city like Sharn and Faerûn, because they just don't have that element of magic being used for a convenience. On the other side, Faerûn is a very high magic setting. There are plenty of capped or even above level 20 NPCs in the world, which to me doesn't give the characters a whole lot of room to really become special in the grand scheme of things. Whereas in Eberron, once you're, you know, into what would be considered like second tier, you're somebody with notoriety. People are aware of your exploits, of who you are. Your name carries weight, and it also precedes you in situations. So as this campaign builds, not only will the gravity of what they're doing increase, so will the feeling of importance that they gain from what they're doing, because eventually they will be the arbiter of like right and wrong in a lot of situations, because their power will be very tough to match. Mm. And that's why I'm putting a lot of effort now into showing them how to go about navigating the world without using power. Because once they do start flinging around power, that can make people nervous. You know, we have that whole X-Men situation where the humans don't feel comfortable with the superpowered people around. And mm-hmm. what do they do to stop them? Yeah. Do you want to see what happens in a world where the NPC or where the PCs now have to be nervous about the intrigue or politics that every person could be playing?
I mean, you start building sentinels, I guess, in response.
Well, we have Warforged as well, which is a really cool situation that you basically have sentinels already baked into the system.
They thought this through, folks. It's good. So are those like your favorite aspects of Eberron, about just how like magic correlates to the rest of the world? And
yeah, I mean, I also like that the economy is very much based on the idea of almost what corporations are, in the sense that dragon-marked houses are really the people that are creating this convenience-based magic system. It keeps the world very similar to ours, in the sense that we all know science exists. We all know that science is what gives us a lot of conveniences, but we don't have a lot of science being just willy-nilly slung around by people who don't understand it for the most part. Whereas in Faerun, you know, magic can just be tossed about by any old schmuck at level 20, and you can have meteor showers coming down, being called out of the heavens, you know, destroying cities in general. In Eberron, it's a very low, very wide magic system where those conveniences are pretty much the top of that power. And people still have to struggle on a daily basis. Class levels are not something that are spread around to just anybody. And that's another reason why I wanted to start the PCs without any classes, was because I wanted them to know what it was like to be an NPC in this world. So that they, yes, they will become special, but they have to remember that the people around them will take offense if they don't give proper reverence to the world and the civilization that's around them.
It reminds me a lot of Dark Heresy by Fantasy Flight Games, which is, hey, you're a pleb, you can die, and everyone else around you can kill you. Good luck.
Yeah, I think that it's important to have that situation. Now, the only difference, I think, with ours is that that one has, like, even like a first edition where it's like, no, go ahead and roll up 35 different characters and get ready as we peel through them. I don't want that to be. I feel like that also creates a layer of separation from what you're doing. So I do want the characters, I do want the PCs to love their characters, or the players to love their PCs. And I do want them to feel a kinship towards each other, which obviously requires that they not only buy in, but become invested in those characters. So I just want to make sure that they have the sense of how insignificant they are, so that they appreciate when they are human.
Absolutely. No, that makes absolute sense, because why make 35 characters when you can love one and just try not to get them killed?
Yeah, I feel like we didn't really talk as much about mechanics as we had initially thought. We were talking a lot more about like theory behind gameplay and approaching story in certain ways, but that's okay. Maybe that gives us opportunities for another run some other time.
Oh, that would be, yes, absolutely. That would be incredible.
I want to make a side note really quick. When Nathan and I were talking the other day about this, and he said, oh, it's an Eberron, I had to explain to Nathan that Eberron is not part of the Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, that's who I am.
No, but that's fair. You're new to D&D. I mean, there's just as much, like, you probably may not know the difference between Greyhawk or Blackmoor or Birthright. But guess what? I've only been doing this for, what are we at now, 3 years? So the only thing that you can do is learn and grow yep. from it. And yep. if you take a moment to spend that time to go, hey, this is something I don't know and I wish I were better at, and I'm correcting myself, it's been longer than 3 years, but it's not been that much longer. If you take the time to say, you know, this is something I don't know and I'm not embarrassed that I don't know it, and sure. I'm excited to learn it because, look, it's fantasy, it's a game. I'm super excited to play a friggin' game. Then you're going to learn, you're going to suck it up. It's going to be like reading yeah. a book that you just can't put down. So
yeah.
So embrace that. Don't be worried or afraid about that.
Excellent.
That's the reason I have Nathan as my co-host on the show, aside from him doing all the audio editing, is because he is your quintessential tabletop newbie. And it makes his point of view on things really interesting, especially when you're talking design.
Yeah, it's actually the point of view of the hero, if you don't know that.
Mm.
Because we all need, no matter what story it is, yeah. the reason that we all go into these same, we watch these movies that have the neophyte who's having the world explained to them and all that stuff isn't just for the exposition. It's because that gives us somebody to relate to. So right. you are essentially playing the part of a hero in any story because you are inexperienced in whatever is going on.
Aha, perfect.
Don't let that go to your head, Nathan.
I just did. Too late. This previous year, I got to do a GMing thing for a live play, and it was pretty much the first time I had ever played a role-playing game. So I got to be the hero while also running the game, too, I guess. Maybe that's a thing I did. I don't know.
We're all heroes.
You learned a lot.
I did learn a lot. I did learn a lot. So that was great. Boy, I did have one big philosophical question, but I feel like you've almost answered it anyway. My big question was, why games matter? I feel like you've kind of answered that.
Let's see if I can summarize that then.
Sure.
Games matter because they give us an opportunity to step outside of ourselves and to distract ourselves from the day-to-day humdrum. They give us the opportunity to experience other people's lives mm-hmm. and to gain empathy for these situations that they may be in. And also, they give us the opportunity to learn from our mistakes before we make them in person. And hopefully that creates a situation for us where we don't create some irrevocable damage. Games for us are very much in the same vein as storytelling, in which we do our best to share our experiences with other people so that we become better, because we only learn by failing and by teaching what we've learned through our failure to others.
That is one of the most complete and wonderful answers I've gotten to that question on our time on the show, so I thank you for that.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I was just, I don't know what he's going to say. And that is, oh, wow. All right. This is awesome. I'm loving every moment of that.
He's dumbfounded now.
Had to take a moment there.
You should hear when I've slept. I'm a little bit more coherent.
that's great. You're doing really well right now. That's the mark of a professional. I'll tell you that right now. Boy, I'll tell you, Rudy, Inkwell Society seems dangerous and terrifying, but I love it. I just love the idea of the setting and starting them off at such a low level. And I think a lot of people are really jiving on it right now. So,
well, great. Make sure when you're in chat, you're saying hi and interacting with our community, because our community is fantastic. They are some of the most welcoming people that I've ever met. And when we see them at conventions and stuff like that, they're just so excited to feel like they belong in a place that isn't just a tidal wave, that they don't just get swept up in the anonymity of the internet. Like you guys saw when you joined the Discord so that we could have the conversation, you know, you got welcomed by one of our mods within minutes. Mm-hmm. With no provocation, just the fact that you guys popped in. they were here and they were like, oh, hey, how are you guys doing? Welcome. What's going on? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And also a shout out to DC Lasser, because he has been kind of our inroads to Maze Arcana in general, and kept telling me how amazing you and Satine are, and that we should really talk to you. And I was like, I'm a little nervous to do that, but I really want to. And so he gave me the push I needed in order to contact you in the first place. So
Good. Yes. Yeah, there's no need to be nervous. We are as accessible as we absolutely can be. And Satine and I have a hard time in saying no to anybody, because we've been in tight spots where we've needed people to reach out and say yes to us. And that's the only reason why we are where we are, is because people gave us that same kindness and courtesy. And so we decided together when we started this business that we wanted to make sure that inclusivity and community were the two strongest pillars amongst our pantheon.
Absolutely. We are very happy that you said yes to us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
I imagine if anyone is interested in getting in touch with you, where could they find you online?
I am presently available anywhere Satine Phoenixes are sold, including the Twitterverse or Instagram at Rudy Woot. You can also come join our Discord. If you don't know how to get a hold of that, watching any of our shows on twitch.tv/MazeArcana will give you a nice inroads, and you can meet DC Lasser, who they are talking about. And he will hook you up with an invite to the Discord. Beyond that, we have a Patreon. You guessed right. It is at patreon.com/MazeArcana. Oh. And we have a lot of little extra perks in there for people, because we appreciate how much that means to be someone's patron. And we take that responsibility seriously, because we know how much a couple of dollars can mean to anybody. Mm-hmm. And it means the world to us, because it allows us to keep making content like this and to keep spreading a wider net for a bigger community that we can engender the appropriate amount of respect for. People aren't numbers for us, they are people.
Absolutely. Wonderful. When does Inkwell Society air?
If you'd like to join us for Inkwell Society, that will be, like I said, on twitch.tv/MazeArcana. We play at 7 p.m. Pacific on Wednesdays. And we are actually going to start doing like a little post-show recap thing as well. And then I try to play the episodes, try to do reruns of the episodes, rebroadcast at a different time frame so that other people in other parts of the world can catch up. Beyond that, you can also see me occasionally on Sirens of the Realms, which is Satine's Phoenix jaunt through the Faerun setting with her all-girl bard band, and that is on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. on twitch.tv/D&D. While you're there, if you want to see some of our other campaigns, we have the what I like to call the Furies section with Furies Reach, which is a campaign that she and I co-dungeon master, moving back and forth between two groups, and then Fury's Reach, which is the aftermath of that with the survivors that made it through Fury's Reach in Chult during the Tomb of Annihilation setting.
that sounds wonderful. that's great. Choice and consequence again.
Yeah, you can see exactly how that plays out even with different groups. We've done some different talks with other people about how you run multiple groups through the same setting. And the answer is you just make their mistakes evident to each other and sometimes impactful.
Is this like that one incident with the head of Vecna?
Kind of. You know what? I won't spoil it. I'll just let people.
Maybe not quite as party shattering as the head of Vecna incident.
Well, we did originally have, I think, roughly 10 players in the first Fury's Reach season. And then when we finished, we had six, only three of whom were the original players from. So Fury's Fate, I think, has six players in it, and only three were from the original 10.
That's pretty brutal.
I mean, it's Chult, and it's the Tomb of Annihilation, and the funny thing is they didn't even go anywhere near the Tomb of Annihilation.
They just got annihilated in the jungles?
A lot of it was the jungles, and it was their search for the pulse of Chult.
That'll do it.
Yep.
And if you're like, what's the pulse of Chult? Well, if you watch, I actually explain what it is, because it's a magic item that we created specifically for the show with Wizards' approval.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
I assume it's... Are the Yuan-Ti from Chult?
There are Yuan-Ti in Chult, yes. They're in history, it's mostly Chult, and then the part of it that was a peninsula moving across that way, the Serpentine Empires and Kingdoms.
Right. See, I've played mostly in Forgotten Realms, so when you say Chult, I'm like, oh, the jungle's down there. I'm like, I've never actually played down in the jungles.
Yeah, it's not the only jungles as well.
You're right, there are more than one set of jungles in Faerun, for sure.
Right, but Chult definitely has that greatest, almost tropical feel to it. And it is where Grung, which I... That's another thing, is that on twitch.tv/D&D, there's a series on there called One Grung Above that is DM'd by Chris Lindsay, and it's one of the few experiences where I get to play, and I have a Grung, and Satine has a Grung, and we are canonized as these two Grung, where she is an orange Grung trying to become a gold, and we are on the quest to make her our gold leader, if you get the reference as well. And
not the red leader.
No.
We
will actually be coming back. We will have another season of that in the near future, which I'm super excited about.
Nice. Very nice.
My little Grung, his name is Bleep. Bleep. He has spent some time adventuring with Minsk, which you see in the first season. And he is just awestruck. Like, Minsk is his, like, he wants Minsk to be his mentor in a way, which is catastrophically wrong on so many levels.
was Boo involved in that at all?
Boo is there, and I do believe that eventually Bleep will realize that Boo might actually be a better mentor than Mince.
that would be a wonderful little side adventure.
Yeah. But I'm currently the little green Grung that is responsible for doing everything, because I'm the only green Grung left in her army. So I literally am doing everything on my own. All of my brothers died.
Oh, noes.
Oh, yeah. And you can see them, too. It used to be Matt Koval, Mark Holmes, and Adam Koval were my brothers, the other greens, and they all died. And I was the only one that continued on, and it's sad. It makes me cry.
That is sad.
All right, we've extended the end of this podcast for a really long time.
Yeah. Let's get on out of there. Rudy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. You guys have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will see everybody next time on Delve. Bye.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you guys are at Origins or going to be at Gen Con or anything like that, make sure you come say hi. Introduce yourselves to me in person so we can know who we're talking to actually.
Right?
Absolutely. We won't, but maybe some of our listeners will.
I was thinking about Gen Con possibly, but I don't know how much that would cost.
A lot.
Mostly the room, because that stuff's expensive.
Yeah, I would look at doing like an Airbnb or something along those lines. Gen Con you got to do a little bit in advance, but we will be at some other cons in the Midwest, and we will be in Europe this year for D&D in a Castle in July.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
We will be looking forward to that, even if we're just there in spirit. Awesome. Rudy, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time, everybody.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful night.
All right.
Thanks.
See ya.
You as well.
Thank you so much.
Yay.
Yeah, and you were in the middle of something, and then all of a sudden, oh, no, no.
Yeah, I'm sure it was profound.
It was profound, it was and
terrific.
We'll...
It was terrific. But that's okay. We'll just move on from there.